Welcome to The Verb. Step inside and taste the language zeitgeist. So sweet and so sharp, so full of the perfume of the next minute and the one after that. Step inside and touch the literary cutting edge, so shiny and gleaming, so full of the possibilities of the sentence and the line, the paragraph and the clause. Step inside and just see what we've got waiting for you, who's sitting round the verb table, just prepared to be profound and entertaining. This week, with a glimpse at the legendary New Eurekan Cafe, the spring from which so much poetry and performance sprung in the form of one of the greats, a graduate of that famous school for slam, here in the studio, Saul Williams. And what sort of poem is this, would you say?
Next to, of course, God, America, I love you, land of the pilgrims, and so forth. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early, my country, 'tis of centuries come and go, and are no more. What of it? We should worry in every language, even deaf and dumb. Thy sons acclaim your glorious name, by gari, by jingo, by gee, by gosh, by gum. Why talk of beauty? What could be more beautiful than these heroic, happy dead, who rushed like lions to the roaring slaughter? They did not stop to think, they died instead. Then shall the voice of liberty be mute? He spoke, and drank rapidly a glass of water.
That's right. It's a sonnet by E.E. Cummings, read by Samuel West. On the programme this evening, we sock it to the sonnet, from the beginning of its time to today's most avant-garde practitioners. Edward Hirsch and Jeff Hilson have both edited very different anthologies of sonnets, but I know they love those 14 lines that have informed and illuminated so much poetry over the years. We'll be asking novelist Matt Thorne if language is a better measure of time than a calendar is. If I say negative equity, or you are fired, or groovy baby, my speech rattles with a kind of contemporary noise that can very soon date. But have the 1990s, so long gone in terms of numbers, not yet left the language building? And we examine what happens when a poet goes to work with a prose pen. The National Poet of Wales, Gillian Clark, joins us with a new book. And it's not poetry, but doesn't it sound like it?
Overhead swept the weather. The glory of living in the Atlantic airstream is weather's variousness. And every manifestation of nature had a weather forecast to its name in Welsh and English. In English it rains cats and dogs. In Welsh it rains knives and forks. In English the night is dark as a cellar. In Welsh it's dark as a cow's stomach. In English literature, rock is symbolically male and water female, but in Welsh, rock is a feminine noun, water masculine. The space between the languages is as dynamic as the huge currents of the Severn estuary between the two shores.
Gillian Clark, and much more from Gillian later. But we start with Saul Williams. As I said, Saul is one of the legendary New Eurekan Cafe poets who were and are responsible for bringing poetry out of the classroom and onto the streets. Over the years he's worked as a writer and an actor and a performer, and he's collaborated with musicians as diverse as the Fugees and those old Radio 3 favourites Nine Inch Nails. Saul is alive to the possibilities of words and to the probability that words can help to change the world. So Saul, a lot of people have heard of the New Eurekan Cafe, but not many of us have been there. So what happens there? What kind of place was that and is it?
Well, when I first started visiting the New Eurekan was in the mid-90s, and for me, it was a response to what I felt I was missing on the radio in music, primarily through hip-hop, where I used to feel this sort of cathartic, lyrical expression happening in the art form, and then as it became more and more commercialized, it was lost. And so instead of becoming a critic, it made me more of an artist, and I went to the New Eurekan and found several other young guys like me, guys and girls like me, who were kind of dissatisfied with what was going on and finding ways of either voicing that dissatisfaction or creating something new without music.
So it was a launch pad for you. So where did it send you? Because you've gone to lots of different places doing your poetry.
Well, I guess the first thing that happened was back in 96. I woke up one Sunday morning with a call from my father to tell me that one of my poems was on the front page of the Sunday Times. Mm. And that ended up, you know, with a director came and saw me perform at the New Eurekan, and it led to my first film, Slam, which ended up winning the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance and the Commodore at the Cannes Film Festival. This was in 1998, which, of course, opened doors to my first record contract, my first book deal, which I've published 4 books overall. Yeah, it's led to everything.
So now it feels like something like the new Eurekan Cafe, which for some people might have felt that it was part of the fringe. That kind of work almost feels part of the mainstream these days.
Well, I think when it first started as well, you know, like in the 70s as well, it may have been part of the mainstream. I think of, you know, in the States, the Last Poets first album in 1970 sold 2 million copies. Mm. You know, Gil Scott-Heron sold lots of poems. So that poetry seems to get popular, you know, in this sort of cyclical form. Whenever there's a movement amongst the people, the first to respond are often the poets, and it seems to blossom then. You know, you wouldn't have had the 60s, you know, movement without the beat poets that preceded it. You wouldn't have had the Black Power movement without the Black Arts movement that preceded it. And now there's certainly a movement going on in the States, and I think the poetry movement that I was a part of in the late 90s was essentially what has led us, you know.
It is fantastic to think of political movements being begun and fed by poetry. So let's hear something. Do you want to perform something for us?
Sure, I'll recite something. This is a poem that I'm actually celebrating the 13th year anniversary of. I wrote it when I was in grad school when I became a father. My daughter, whose name is Saturn, is 12 years old now, and I started writing this thinking about what it would be like to become a father and intuitively grasping the possibility that it was going to be a girl. And so this is called Children of the Night. I'll read an excerpt of it because it may be kind of along. And out of the sun's gates come little girls in dresses of fire, wearing pigtails of braided smoke which stem from their moon-cratered scalps, the glowing seeds of a nightly garden that will blossom into full moons irregardless of the sun. They know the night and the seven names of the wind through the tales of their wind-blown fathers. Who will father these mothers of light, and what will become of me, children of the night? Only some will star the sky, only believers in death will die, and fathers must feather the wings of women, for the unfeathered masses dangle ridiculous, carrying crosses to phallic-filled tombs. The future sails silent through blood-rivered wombs that ripple with riddles of cows and spoons and births, moons, and earth, sun-centered at noon. She buries her eggs in the soil and plants her feet in the sky. At the feet of forever, the children are gathered or rather buried in that mass graveside of the night. They are the seeds of light planted in the sky, but then nights and skies are meaningless to their unearthly eyes. They are our children, playing chess on the sunburnt backs of one-eyed turtles, checkmating a lifetime soul crawl to enlightenment, casting in their crown and glory for magic and contradiction. The children of fiction, born of semen-filled crosses thrust in Calvary's mound, with memories of mañana's millennium, the gravity of the pendulum, the inscription of the grail, the rumors of war and famine, diseases and storms of hail. All hail the new beginning, behold the winter's end. Bring on the puppets and dragons, let the ceremonies begin. For they have come to shatter time and bring back the dead newborn, an army of me, bearing change in the front lines and shadows in the field mines to wilderness the lights of the city. I have seen them, orbiting the realms of the ordinary through the ordinances of those ordained by the beast. These are our children, love-laden life lanterns casting shadows that shepherd the flocks, crying wolf in the moon's full as sirens of love's lull, the offspring of Gibraltar's rocks. Who will deny them and thrice crows the cock?
So, that was fantastic. That was,
thank you.
That was very, very exciting. It's interesting, I wonder how your compositional method for writing that. I can't imagine. I wanted to walk up and down while you were performing it. I wonder if there's a very mobile thing about that, isn't there? Did you have to physically get up and walk when you're performing that?
Well, at
or
the
writing
time,
it, I mean,
when I wrote that poem, I wrote it, it was the most time I'd ever spent on a poem. There was a lot of being up and about, but my writing process is pretty much, it's quite simple. You know, I carried a journal in my back pocket, and it's kind of like a speak when spoken to, you know, speak when spoken through. It's just when inspiration strikes, I would jot down an idea, a passage, but it would usually be preceded by me, like this poem became my mantra, you know, so that I would, you know, consistently recite everything that I had written up into whatever point, and that's what would lead me to the next stanza. Yeah.
So was the poem getting longer and longer, or was it getting sort of tighter and tighter as you were writing?
A bit of both. This was the first time that I my challenge to myself with this poem was that I wanted every stanza to be able to stand alone on a page. you know? And so, in many ways, of course, that sort of editing process will make it succinct, but at the same time, it was growing longer because...
And you were publishing at the time. This was something that was going to go into print, or was it?
No. I hadn't published anything at the time. This was just something that I was writing. It was going to go into my daughter.
Gillian Clark, I mean, you were very much involved in Wales with the oral scene. There's a very much a spoken poetry. How do you react to a piece like that?
I was dying to speak about it. I mean, I've never heard it before, and the first lines stay in my mind and will stay in my mind forever. Oh, it's got the energy, I think, of the very best of Dylan Thomas. Mm-hmm. You know, the imagery moving and tangling, and the nursery rhymes and the vision of the little girls and their pigtails like smoke,
yes,
and the sun's gate. I think that's a most wonderful poem. I can't wait to read it. More of it.
Thank you.
I think you're in the spirit of Dylan Thomas. And by the way, my name was Williams, and it's a very Welsh name, so no wonder you're good.
Let's hear another one. Can you do something else for us?
Sure. Good God. Okay. This one is called 1987. It's a bit different. Acid-washed guests with the leather patches, sporting the white Diodoras with the hoodie that matches. I'm wearing two swatches and a small Gucci pouch. I could have worn the Louis, but I left it in the house. Now my niggas do some weighing. I go play with their name with the skyline on it with the box link chain. I'm wearing my frame to match my gear with they tent. And you know Lagerfeld is the scent. Now my man Raphael just got his beard at the shop. Mint green sidekick, custom-made ragtop. Strictly Business is the album that we play. You're a customer, the pick of the day. Now there's this nigga on the block, never seen him before, selling incense and oil so man think that he's the law. But why on earth would this be on their agenda as he slowly approaches the window? I've seen you before, I've been you and more. I was the one bearing the pitcher of water. I rent the large upper room furnished with tidings of your doom or pleasure, whichever feathers decree. Yo, Ralph, is he talking to me? No, I'm talking to the sea, sun's resurrected. I'm the solstice of the day. I bring news from the blues of the Caspian. My man laughs, he one of them crazy mother. Turn the music back up, cause I'm the E-double. Wait, but I know the volume of the sea and sound waves as I will. Will you allow me to be at your service? My man Ralph is nervous. He believes his strange tongue deceives, and maybe he's been informed that he's pushing gats in the back beneath the floor mats. Can't jack in a time for your bull playing. Aslam or something, another. Wait, isn't Juanita your mother? I told you. I know you. Now grant me a moment. At the gates of Atlantis we stand. Ours is the blood that flows from the palms of his hands on the plow. Till earth, till I'm now. Moon cycles he visited. Womb food of the sun. Full moon of occasion. Wave the wolves as they run. And we run towards the light, casting love on the wind, as is the science of the aroma of sleeping women. She, the firstborn daughter of water, faced darkness and smiled. Took mystery as her lover and raised light as her child. Man, that issue's why you should have seen how they ran. She woke up in the alley with a gun in her hand. Tupac and Lotus form, and it's his blood on his hands. She woke up on a vessel, the land behind her, the sun within her, water beneath her, mushed corn for dinner. Or was it breakfast? Her stomach turned as if a compass. She prayed east and lay there breathless. They threw her overboard for dead. She swam silently and fled into the blue sea. La so fa mi re do. See, the seventh octave. I don't mean to confuse you. Many of us have been taught to sing, and so we practice scales. Many of us were born singing, and thus were born with scales. Mermaids, cooks, and field hands sang a night song by the forest, and the ocean was the chorus in Atlantis where they sang. Those thrown overboard had overheard the mysteries of the undertow and understood that down below there would be no more chains. They surrendered breath and name and survived countless's reign. I'm the weatherman, the clouds say storm is coming. A white buffalo was born, already running. And if you listen very close, you'll hear a humming. Beneath the surface of our purpose lies rumor of ancient rain, dressed in cloud-faced minstrels, the sky. The moon's my mammy, the storm holds my eye. Dressed in westerlies, robed by robes, and old man river knows my name. And the reason you were born is the reason that I came.
Oh, so fantastic. We'd clap. I said it'd be the worst gig you ever did, because there's only three of us in the room. All right, thanks very much, Saul Williams. There'll be more from Saul later in the show, and you can find out all about Saul's current tour of the UK at saulwilliams.com. Now, I'm proud to welcome back Gillian Clark to The Verb. For many years now, Gillian's led what you have to call a poetic life in the heart of Wales. Reading, writing, teaching, running workshops, serving on committees have been a visible reminder that countries without poets are just maps on tea towels. Gillian talked about her last collection of poems, a response to the foot and mouth crisis, Making the Beds for the Dead, here on The Verb a couple of years ago. And now she's brought out a prose memoir called At the Source, subtitled A Writer's Year. And as you heard at the start of the programme, it's really what you've got to call a poet's prose. Now, Gillian, the centrepiece of the book is this journal. And it interests me because it reads as though it was always intended for publication. And I wonder, when you're as experienced as you are, and you've been writing as long as you have, and you're a national poet, is it possible not to write for publication?
Oh, that's very interesting. I'd never thought of that. My diary is not secret. My journals are not secret, but on the other hand, they're not. The National Library can't have them yet. I suppose I write in order to say to whoever, my husband, my children, one day, this is how it was that day. To remind myself and to remind other people of what was happening on that particular day. And I've written a journal since I was, well, a child, but certainly I've got the journal since I was 15, and I've been writing them very, very steadily in the last 20, 30 years. And I love writing. It starts my day. I love writing. Love recording what's happening. I like putting down what the weather is. I like talking about the woodpecker.
But it feels like to me as well, it's a kind of making sense of a bigger life, as it were.
Yes. I mean, I am a writer. I can't help it. I write all the time. I think writing. I drive. And, you know, what's going on around me on the road is turning itself into language. I used to think, well, everybody did that. I think most people do, sort of.
Yeah,
we talk
to
ourselves. We are the centre of some sort of narrative. We're centre of our own story, I suppose. And we're the witnesses. I suppose I think that the writer is a witness of what's happening. And it's not, I don't write fiction. I love poetry because it's not fiction. It may tell stories, but they're true stories. And I love reading books of geology, paleontology, and history stuff, books about trees and so on, because they're not fiction. They are the real earth. I just love the stuff about the real earth.
But in the end, then, do you think, then, that writing is just the thing for you, that publication in the end might not be that important, that if you weren't getting published, you'd still be writing?
Well, I never thought anybody would publish me. I was writing for the first, you know, like, say, from when I was, when I first could write until I was 30, without ever thinking I'd have anything published. And as for my journals, I don't know if anybody will publish them. They're there. I will bequeath them to my family, and it's up to them. I don't know, but I just have dived into those journals for the last couple of years to produce something that recorded what I wanted to record, and then flashed back to record other things, to remember other things that I wanted to remember.
All right, well, I tell you what, let's hear a bit. There's a passage in the book, in the essay, called The Lineage of Bees, which seems to me to go to the heart of your book. Could you read the bit about the otter and the osprey for us?
Yes, indeed. Our otter that comes to our pond, right, here we go. Our night visitor was certainly an otter. We've never seen it, but for us it is always present, part of the pond's story. The splash, the prints, and the frog's skull clean as the moon. The absent otter is as real as the osprey I missed at Cwm Tiddy. It was the last night of a course at Tynewydd, where I had been tutoring for the week, when David phoned to tell me the news. A migrating osprey had been sighted at Cwm Tiddy, taking a rest on its journey from Lapland to Africa. Local people had been feeding its fish from the chip shop, and kept it a secret to protect it and to keep twitchers away. I couldn't sleep for imagining the great white bird, and for longing to get home to see it. Next evening, we sat on the cliffs over the sea for hours, until we were frozen stiff, while the imagined osprey soared above the cliffs and the sea, its absence as haunting as a presence. The pond contains the otter, as Cwm Tiddy contains the osprey. They haunt the word pond, the name Cwm Tiddy. All words are haunted.
Seems to me, Gillian, that is your particular concern, isn't it? The haunting of words. I wonder if that is due to coming from a nation of two languages.
It helps, I think. I mean, if you are a writer, it couldn't be a better place to be, in a way, side by side or in the middle of two languages going on all the time. And it is the British language. It was the first language of Britain.
But in Wales, though, can you avoid feeling that the Welsh word is always going to be better, more poetic, more accurate and more suggestive of history than the English word, because the Welsh word was there first?
No. No. The Welsh word is sometimes more wonderful, but sometimes the English word is more wonderful because of other things that it has brought in. I mean, what is fantastic about Welsh is its ancientness and the fact that it didn't sort of ossify and die, but because the Romans came, because the Normans came, because of all the things that brought their words to Welsh. Therefore, it's fit for modern life. But English, which is a much younger language, has a huge geography. And it has brought it. Think of the poetry we've heard today, where all of that hip hop and Britain in particular, I think, is rich in the words that have come in. And in fact, of course, English is full of Welsh. The word Dover, the town of Dover, comes from Dyfroedd, which is the plural for water. And the modern word, it's the modern word for the plural of water, waters. And the modern word for water is dŵr, which has dropped the V sound, but it's the same word, and it's ancient. And Dover, can you imagine the people going to the cliff looking at, they didn't have any other language, they looked at the water and they said, Dover.
I want to tell the people of Dover that. So, now, finally, your book is called At the Source. What do you think is the source for you, and perhaps for all of us who write? We've perhaps mentioned it already in terms of language, but is it for you place, is it language, is it history?
It's the first sounds we ever heard when we were tiny. And as when we heard more and more, we accumulated more and more, and our brains and imagination took in more and more and more of those sounds. And as that gradually turned into sentences and gained abstracts, and it turned into what a wonderful, wonderful thing a language is. Source, actually, I've called it that because my house is called Blaen Cwrt, and Blaen means source. And there is a little tiny streamlet which finds its source in the garden. So it's the source of language and the source of water, etc., etc.
Because in the book as well, you've got this image of the road to the world beginning at your gate.
Yes, but everybody's gate has got the road to the whole world, hasn't it?
Well, mine's got the road to a skip at the moment. In a sense, it's the world.
Isn't the whole world is in the skip.
It's all worlds in that skip.
You need to live at the back of beyond like I do, Ian.
I've been there and it's very nice. The back of beyond is very nice. I'd like to go back. Gillian Clark, thank you very much. And Gillian's new book, At the Source, is out now, published by the wonderful Carcanet. Now, the sonnet is one of my favourite forms because it seems like the perfect shape for a poem, at once loose and sculpted, at the same time tiny and fathomless, and most importantly, the sonnet is a kind of mystery. Two new books celebrate and evaluate the sonnet, and I'm joined by two of their creators. From the Verbs New York studio, by the poet and critic Edward Hirsch, whose new book, The Making of the Sonnet, edited with Evan Boland, is an anthology celebrating the last five and a bit centuries of the form. And here, at the Verb table, we've got Jeff Hilson, poet and lecturer in creative writing at Roehampton University, who's been editing a new collection of 20th and 21st century sonnets that prove that the form is alive and well. So first, Edward, in New York, how and why did you become interested in sonnets?
Well, of course, I knew what sonnets were from school, where they were treated as some kind of bad medicine that we had to take. I came across a poem by Robert Frost called Acquainted with the Night that spoke to me very deeply, and I had a deep response to the poem, and it was only later, looking back at it, that I realized that actually it was a sonnet.
Because it does originate in Sicily. I mean, people know about Petrarch and Dante, but it's not too well known. The sonnet originates in Sicily. Could you tell us a bit about that?
The sonnet began in around 1235 or so, in the court of Frederick II, who was the Holy Roman Emperor and also King of Sicily. And it was invented by a group of notaries or poet lawyers sitting around the court who began to write poems that they called sonatos, which means little song. And they were the first inventors of this surprisingly durable form.
I love the idea of poet lawyers. That's a great idea. Now, the sonnet... Go on.
I was just going to say it's a peculiar thing, but I think it actually tells us something about the sonnet, which has often been an extremely rhetorical form. It's oddly argumentative. So in a certain way, it's not a surprise that lawyers came up with such an argumentative form in poetry.
That's true. Now, the sonnet travels from Sicily to mainland Italy and eventually to our own fair island. Let's hear one of the English masters. This is Thomas Wyatt, read by Samuel West.
My galley, charged with forgetfulness, through sharp seas in winter nights doth pass, tween rock and rock, and eke my foe, alas, that is my lord, steereth with cruelness, and every oar a thought in readiness, as though that death were light in such a case. An endless wind doth tear the sail apace of forced sighs and trusty fearfulness. A rain of tears, a cloud of dark disdain, have done the wearied cords great hindrance, wreathed with error, and eke with ignorance. The stars be hid that led me to this pain. Drowned is reason that should me consort, and I remain despairing of the port.
My galley charged with forgetfulness. And Edward, it's true that over the ages the sonnet has had one overriding concern in many ways, which is erotic love, isn't it?
The sonnet's been obsessed with Eros. Of course, Petrarch made it a great, made it the great subject of European poetry in a certain way, an idealized love. But it's come down to us first as a love poem, and then, of course, it expanded wildly to include other subjects. This poem, this beautiful poem that was just read, is really a kind of adaptation from one of Petrarch's reams. And Wyatt's the one who brought the sonnet and the sonnet's compulsions into English poetry.
Now, in a moment, I'm going to bring in Jeff Hilson. But just before that, let's hear the sonnet be used for a very different purpose. This is Patrick Kavanagh, played by Sammy West again.
I have lived in important places, times when great events were decided. Who owned that half a rood of rock, a no-man's land surrounded by our pitchfork arm at claims? I heard the Duffies shouting, "Damn your soul!" And old McCabe, stripped to the waist, seen step the plot, defying blue-cast steel. Here is the march, along these iron stones! That was the year of the Munich bother. Which was more important? I inclined to lose my faith in Ballyrush and Gorton, till Homer's ghost came whispering to my mind. He said, "I made the Iliad from such a local row. Gods make their own importance."
That was Epic by Patrick Kavanagh. Edward, that was an unusual kind of sonnet in that it took a personal thing from the start and widened it out, didn't it, into a very, very wide political sphere.
It's adapt the sonnet. I mean, it shows how adaptable the sonnet is, but I think there's a wonderful wit in the poem that begins, "I've lived in important places," and you think this is a poem called Epic, and then it turns it down towards the local or the provincial, the parochial, and then it winds it out in this extraordinary way to show that actually this is exactly the sort of subject that Homer took to make the Iliad.
Now, Jeff Hilson, I think a lot of the things in your book, there's a political edge to them, isn't there? And I know you're writing, you're thinking about the sonnet's place in what they call the poetry wars. Mm. Can you tell us about that?
Mm. Well, the modernists, of course, Williams most famously and Ezra Pound both declared the sonnet to be a dead form. So it came really as something of a surprise to me, at least, when I was compiling this anthology, to find so many linguistically innovative poets. Mm. It's not a great phrase, no. But engaging with the form in all sorts of different ways, beginning with Edwin Denby for me, and that's where I start the anthology. Mm. A poet who I don't think is very well known these days. I mean, he's probably more well known for his dance criticism than for his poetry. But I was surprised to find that there were so many poets who I admired writing sonnets that I hadn't actually been aware of, to be honest.
And it feels to me that your book is a kind of radical manifesto as well for the future of the sonnet.
Well, Ted Berrigan famously ends one of his poems with, "I love you and the sonnet is not dead," you know, written and published in 1963.
Now, Edward, in your book, I think we've got Edwin Denby and we've got Ted Berrigan, so you must also see the sonnet as a form that's got legs, as it were.
Well, one of the odd things about the sonnet is that it adapts to different languages, and also it adapts to different aesthetics. That is, new formalists or poets who think of themselves as traditional, say in American poetry, Anthony Hector, Richard Wilbur, write sonnets and are great masters of the sonnet. At the same time, it's proved to be a remarkably radical form, and most of the innovative poets have tried their hand at sonnets, and the sonnet just keeps... I think it's because the sonnet is a way of turning... You are reacting to some kind of traditional power, and the poet is enabled to innovate something within a contained space, and the sonnet just keeps reinventing itself through experimentation.
Let's hear one of these more experimental sonnets. This is by Sophie Robinson, and then we'll talk about it.
The upright nature of a girl... Belied by formless whirs, signs of visible lust, like the density of skies, and the disappearing hour, I think of you urgent and weak, walking beside billboards, missing out, flaking off in the silence between two tracks. No tender riot in your geek heart, spliced open and pulsating in four different places, whilst the summer is blaring, musty and lithe, awful shiny skin and sick tune of birds germinating light as a new kind of loudness. And the crude urban cosmos misses you and is just passing the time with dirt and money and pouting in the corner without your nocturno-suspicious lure.
I do like that very much. That's Sophie Robinson's sonnet read by Samuel West. But, Jeff, on the page, it's a very interesting looking thing, because we can't see it, it's just a square. It's got 14 lines, but there are no rhymes within it. So I just wonder, the first question is, how is that a sonnet?
Well, one of the things that that I've tried to do with this anthology is include poems which respond visually as well to the form. I mean, it is... as much an oral form, it's a visual form. I mean, you look at a sonnet, you know it's a sonnet when you see it. And I think I've been interested by poets who take that form and mess with it visually. I mean, you could almost see it as a prose sonnet.
She's taking the traditional form of the subject, the traditional subject of the sonnet, and turning it on its head by making, you know, a woman who's rapacious in her desire, rather than being the idealized subject of the poem.
Indeed, and in fact, the use of the word belied in the first line might remind us of Shakespeare's use of that very word in one of his most famous sonnets, the couplet which ends, "And yet by heaven I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compares."
And I was saying something here about the nature of power in poetry here, that because the power of the sonnet is so great, it is also capable of the greatest subversion.
I think that's a fair comment. It's for me, in a way, the sonnet is a kind of... It's something of a paradox, because it should be, in this day and age, a kind of impossibility, I think. And yet, it has a vitality, and those two things going together, the impossibility and the vitality, I think what makes it such a compelling and enduring form.
Edward, do you agree with that?
I do, and I think it's one of the ways in which poets test themselves. There, you might say that there's the impersonality of the form, and then there's the radical individuality of the person, the particular poet. And you find in the form the meeting of these two things, where there are the rules, the indifference, if you were, the tradition, and then there's the individual poet, you know, testing his or her individuality against the determinants of the form. The sonnet also adapts to French, it also adapts to German, it also adapts to Welsh.
That's right.
It adapts to all different languages for reasons that really we really not quite sure, but it does seem to be in touch with speech.
Well, finally, just from each of you, from Edward and Jeff, perhaps recommend us one sonnet writer that we may not have heard of that we should revive. So Edward first. Living or dead, it could be. What would you recommend, Edward?
Well, I mean, I really don't know what your readers know, but I love the Hebrew poet Yehuda Amichai, and he has some wonderful sonnets, including one called "A Pity We Were Such a Good Invention."
All right, and Jeff?
Just thinking off the top of my head, I would certainly recommend the sonnets of Tim Atkins. He wrote some very, very minimal sonnets that were published in 2000, and he's now translating Petrarch in all sorts of interesting ways.
Oh, great. And I recommend from both books, there's some great poems, but I like the one, is it Paul Dutton who's just made the sonnet out of the word sonnet?
The word sonnet, yeah. Fantastic. Variations on
Variations on the word sonnet. It sounds like whistling through a pipe. It's, I read it aloud on the train the day, empty the carriage, but it's such a fantastic thing. Edward Hirsch and Jeff Hilson, thank you very much. The Reality Street Book of Sonnets, edited by Jeff, is out very soon from the wonderful Reality Street Editions. And The Making of a Sonnet, edited by Edward and Evan Boland, is available now from the equally wonderful Norton. And, in the cause of even-handedness, I've got to tell you that other wonderful publishers are available. And thanks to the wonderful Samuel West for those wonderful performances. And other wonderful actors are available, but not on the day we needed them, and not at that price. You're listening to The Verb with me, Ian McMillan. I was in a taxi the other day, you know, here in London, and the driver turned to me and said, "Hey, you're that lyrical geezer, aren't you?" And indeed I am. And if you want to listen to all the lyrical geezers and lyrical gals we've got on this show for up to 7 days, then avail yourselves of our Lyrical Listen Again facility, details of which can be found on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio3, and follow the Verby Brick Road to The Verb. And if you got your diary handy, let me mark your card with news of our next live Verb on Friday, July the 4th, in the Radio Theatre here in the heart of London's throbbing West End. Tickets are free, but you've got to get them in advance from 0870 901 1227. That's 0870 901 1227. But be warned, at the very least, you'll be charged 8 pence per minute. But your applause, laughter and murmurings of appreciation can help make radio history. Now, let's rap about language, except the word rap, that once seemed so modern and with it and street, has changed meaning. And now, if you use the word in the old way, you're either beached or you're up the creek, which are also phrases that have passed their sell-by date. I'm joined to look at the cultural ripples that specifically time-based language makes by Matt Thorne, novelist, friend of The Verb, and co-founder of the literary movement known as the New Puritans. So Matt, to start us off, we asked you to write down some of your thoughts on this, so you read us your thoughts, and then we'll debate hotly.
Okay. We're 8 years into the current decade, and we still don't have an agreed name for it. The noughties? Impossible to say without cringing. The zeros? Sounds like a sitcom about slackers or a pretentious Hoxton band. My favourite coinage so far comes from Douglas Coupland, the phrase-making novelist who first used McJobs and Generation X. He calls it the wretched decade, which seems to perfectly encapsulate the mood of our times. Language is in constant flux, with words and phrases going through a series of changes in meaning and intonation, sometimes being used seriously, other times ironically. Metrosexual has gone from concept to compliment to term of abuse in a matter of years. Among the few words in English slang that has kept the same status since World War II is cool. Popularised by jazz musicians, it has even survived being used to package bland collections of trip-hop in the mid-90s under the title The Rebirth of Cool. There is something slightly suspect about the word today, but most people still use it, and the Enemy still publishes an annual cool list without irony or embarrassment. Compare this to groovy, which became an embarrassing word to use, then was revived ironically with the popularity of the Easy Listening revival and Mike Myers' Austin Powers, before almost returning to its original meaning. When words return from the past, it is often a result of language sampling, in which words or phrases are borrowed from their original context and given new meaning, in the same way as music samples. At the risk of sounding like a groovy academic, I asked my students why they were signing off their emails with boat drinks, and they explained it's a piece of rap slang inspired by a 1979 song by Jimmy Buffett, referring to the strong rum cocktails people drink on boats, which means someone attempting to get very, very drunk. Hip-hop has also popularised a number of useful contractions, such as IMA, which tightens I'm going to into three letters. Grime music has seen a number of new coinages, many violent, such as shower to mean good, coming from shower face, which is the face you make when you shower someone with bullets, or murk for murder, which means to beat another MC, and lips to lip someone, which means to kiss. And legal phrases often have a quick route into common currency. When they came up with antisocial behaviour orders, did they realise how quickly ASBOs would become a badge of honour?
Ah, Matt Thorne, thank you very much. So, do you think it's true, then, that language is a useful way of measuring time? Saul Williams, what do you think about this? Because it's a constant movement, isn't it? Language is moving and changing all the time.
Well, I think it's simply a reflection of us. You know, we're moving and changing all the time, and I think that there's a need for ownership of language for each generation, you know, so that, you know, for instance, you look at what my generation in America has done to the word nigger, for example, mm-hmm. you know, how we've taken it from its roots and made it mean something different for us, which makes old tribes, old people crazy, and makes young people go, no, no, it means my best friend. You know, like, I think that sense of ownership, and I think you can kind of, you know, chronicle time with it for sure, and the understanding of it, you know, just the connotation versus the denotation shifts so much. You think of a word like repent, you know, which for many people means, you know, to fall on their knees and beg for forgiveness, which comes from, you know, pensare. It means rethink, reset, think again.
I think words stick around if they're useful. I mean, I think one of the things about that, the reason we kept cool as a word for so long is it's so hard to come up with an alternative. I mean, it fills a purpose that we can't really get rid of.
Jeff Hilson, I mean, you work a lot in that area of language writing, which really is cutting edge. And do you find people, I guess that kind of writing is timeless, isn't it, in a way?
I was just thinking, would you use a word like cool or asbo in a piece of writing? And if you use it in a piece of writing, I mean, what does that do to the word? Does it solidify it? Does it petrify it? Or what? I mean, it's a difference between when you set these things down in writing or when you use them as parts of everyday speech. There's a kind of slippage between the two.
Well, I think you want to convey the idea of cool instead of writing the word cool. You can't write the word cool and expect it to come off as cool. So if you're choosing between the two, you want it to come off as cool, which means you don't use the word.
A lot of novelists have said in the past that they don't want to use current slang because they think it dates the book, and they often make up slang. But I think there's nothing wrong with a book dating. I think a book being a record of its era is just.
So, Gillian, what do you think about that? The idea that our poets, the unacknowledged legislators of the language, are we? Is it part of our job to make up new words and new phrasings?
Definitely make new words. I tell you what, I'd use words say like cool in a radio play because that would be a dialogue and it would reflect the nowness of it. But I wouldn't put it in a poem that I wanted to last a long time. But actually, I don't watch enough television. I get all my new language from teenagers, and I never get it from television. So usually I'm totally bemused by all the things that everybody else knows.
I'll tell you what, the linguist Mark Abley was also, he writes novels. He does this thing when he goes into schools in Britain and America and Canada. At the end of the writing session, he gets every young person to write down one word that he says he won't have heard of.
That's very good idea.
And they get some fantastic words, and some of them, they're the kind of micro language that won't move outside that classroom, but some of them are new words. Now, Mark Abley also says, Matt, in his new book about language, he says that hip-hop has been the main English language generator of new language for the past few decades. What do you think of that?
I'd agree with that. I mean, I'd be more interested to hear what Saul has to say.
Yeah, Saul, what do you think?
It's definitely true. I would say that even, not only language, but I would say that, you know, because of the academic stance that has been quietly held, kind of opposed to hip-hop, that a lot of, you know, contemporary professors of poetry are actually a bit behind, because I would say that new forms of meter and stanza have been created within the world of hip-hop that unless you're checking for it, you're not hip to. You know,
I mean, it also moves very quickly. I mean, it is a sense of it does have a kind of newspaper feel because the music is changing and happening.
Exactly.
I always feel, I've used this analogy before, but I always feel like the curate who's going to the youth club with his S Club 7 albums under his arm. I always feel just that one bit too far behind.
I've reached the point where S Club 7's become cool again.
That's true. So yes, I'm always been with the zeitgeist. I always have, only just though. Matt Thorne, thank you very much. Matt's latest novel is Cherry. I'd like to thank all my other guests this week: Gillian Clark, Jeff Hilson, Edward Hirsch and Saul Williams. Next week, Paul Batchelor, a marvellous new poet from Newcastle upon Tyne, and new work from novelist Ruth Thomas, a lyrical gal and a lyrical geezer, and poet Ira Lightman will be here recreating Miltonic composition using a blindfold and a quill. The question is not why, but how. And to send us swinging into the weekend, here's Saul Williams. One more piece from Saul. Thank you very much.
Cool. I could recite the grass on a hill and memorize the moon. I know the cloud forms of love by heart and have brought tears to the eye of a storm. My memory banks vaults of autumn forests and Amazon river banks, and I've screamed them into sunsets that echo in earthquakes. Shadows have been my spotlight as I monologue the night and dialogue with days, soliloquies of wind and breeze applauded by sun rays. We put language in zoos to observe caged thought and tossed peanuts and pea-funk at intellect, and everyone thinks these are metaphors. I speak what I see. All words and worlds are metaphors of me. My life is authored by the moon for footprints written in soil, the fountain pen of Martian man noveling human toil. And yes, the soil speaks highly of me, when earth seeds root me, poet, tree, and me forest forever through recitation. Now, maybe I'm too serious, too little here, to matter, though I'm riddled with the reason of the sun, a stand-up comet with the audience of lungs. This body of laughter, is it with me or at me, you more or less you man, though gender's mute, and the punchline has this lifeline at its root. I'm a star, this life's the suburbs, I commute, make daily runs between the sun and earthly lewd, and raise my children to the height of light and truth.
Saul Williams performing part of his poem Wine. The Verb was presented by Ian McMillan and produced by Horatio Clare. On Friday the 4th of July, The Verb will come live from the Radio Theatre here at the Broadcasting House in London. And if you'd like to be in the audience, you can get free tickets by going to The Verb's website for more details or by calling this number, 0870 901 1227. 0870 901 1227. Calls from a landline cost up to 8 pence a minute. Some operators and mobiles may vary.
Opera on Three this week offers a treat. The only appearance this year by Bryn Terwyl on the operatic stage as Verdi's Falstaff. Verdi's setting of Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor follows the roguish fat knight's get-rich-quick scheme, which involves seducing the wives of local rich men, with many a twist and complication along the way. Verdi's Falstaff, Opera on Three, starting at 6:30 tomorrow evening, here on BBC Radio 3.